Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Birchie. It's our big, big, giant, huge Revenge of the Aughts show. Long time coming. Been working on this for a long time. Justin's here.
I am. How is everyone doing?
Not so bad. Not so bad. And our special guests this time around, we've got... first time, besides Bamboo, we've had an ANN critic on one of these episodes, but we definitely wanted to get his take on this stuff. It's Theron Martin. Hey, Theron.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for joining us, man.
Pleased to be here.
On our fantastic journey through the last decade. And a friend of the show, you can find her on That Guy with the Glasses and various other places around the internet. It's Hope Chapman. Hey, Hope.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on board.
Yep, excited to be here. Have plenty of stuff to drink handy, so yeah.
Great, good. You're going to need it. Okay, so like the other shows, we're counting down our top tens and then we're going to read user lists. We may as well just dive in here. These are our personal top tens for this past decade. I personally make no indication that I think these are objectively the best titles from the 2000s. They're my favorites, and for a variety of reasons. But let's just go ahead and get into it here. And up top, if you want to list some of your also-rans, some of your runners-up, maybe some things you were surprised didn't make it onto your list... and also, you know, your process and how exactly you decided on these ten titles. So let's start with Theron. You're up. You're up first, buddy.
All right. Well, when I was looking at what would be the 10 titles I would go with for this, the primary two factors I looked at were writing quality and did the title do something particularly distinctive. Mm-hmm. Once I got beyond that, I looked at secondary factors. I looked at, did it have good artistry and technical merits? Was it very entertaining? Did it have a lot of rewatch value? But those were all kind of secondary factors for me. Basically, I took a list of all the titles that came out in the 2000s, because we can do that with our resources here on ANN. And I went through and I picked out six titles that I thought were surefire inclusions. And those ended up being basically my top five plus one of the lower ones. And then I made a list of about 19 or 20 other titles that I thought were at least worth considering. And then over time, I gradually whittled those down to the four I was going to include, about six honorable mentions, and about 10 also-rans, I guess you would say.
Yikes.
Okay. Because I aimed a bit more for quality than just purely what were my favorites. Some of my favorite titles didn't end up making it on the list. Like, for example, I'm a really big fan of Mayahime and Mayotome. And neither one of those, objectively speaking, though, I think could be considered within, say, the top 20 titles of the decade. So I had to kind of leave those behind. Some of the titles that I didn't make that are on my also-ran list would include things like Bacano and Metropolis, Saikano, Scrap Princess, 12 Kingdoms, Paprika. All these are titles that I thought were good titles, but they just weren't really what I was looking for my list. Hmm. My honorable mentions would include things like Boogie Pop Phantom, Living for the Day After Tomorrow, which I would probably consider to be maybe my number 11 title.
Right.
I really wanted to include that one because it was so well written, but there was just too much other stuff to fit in there. And then some other stuff that I kind of expect that might possibly be on some other people's lists, like Eden of the East and Genkutsu and Haibani Renmai. And the last title I considered, unfortunately didn't have time to finish watching this one, was Red Line.
Oh, wow, okay.
Which I kind of suspect might be on somebody else's list. I love the... I think it's a incredibly impressive visual production, but it's just not really the kind of visual style that I like. So that ended up being the deciding factor there.
Then that brings us, I guess, to your number 10. What is your number 10?
Okay, well, my number 10 is perhaps a little bit of an unusual inclusion. I went with Samoon, 2006 series from Studio Dean. And I know Studio Dean kind of has a pretty bad reputation with a lot of fans, but this is probably their best title.
I don't even recall what this is.
Yeah, and it's somewhat of a more obscure title, too. I would bet it probably never sold too well, because even though it did get an American release, it was only released, I think, subbed only. Basically, it's a title that's set in a world where everyone is born female. And at a certain point in their lives, they have to, in the one particular country that this series focuses on, they have to go to a spring dedicated to the god of that country and make a decision about whether or not they're going to be male or female as an adult. And that alone, I thought, was an absolutely fascinating concept, because it's not something that you just ever see done really anywhere before. You have characters who have to make a decision about what gender they're going to be. And what do you make such a decision on? Well, some characters in the series make that decision based on things like, oh, it's easier to get a job if I'm a man, or, oh, I'm going to be a man for you. I mean, that's taken literally in the series when characters say that. So it's a really intriguing question just to base an entire series on. For those who haven't gone to the spring yet, as they put it, those with proper lineage and training can become the priestesses of that country, or what they're called Sibylle in the series. And the most elite priestesses go out and fly these divine aircraft called Samoon, which are intended basically to be a part of a process of like praying to the god, but they're also the most maneuverable and powerful warships in this world too, by kind of a coincidence. And so they also get this situation set up where the priestesses are simultaneously flying to do their prayers, but yet they're also stuck having to do basically military duty too. And a second concept that the series explores deeply is that religious issue there of where do you draw the line between religion and being a soldier? Well, some of the girls in the series regard themselves more as priestesses. Others regard themselves as soldiers. And that becomes an issue throughout the series. There is even one episode where they have a suicide bomber, a religiously motivated suicide bomber that's involved too. So it gets into some pretty involved issues there. And then you also have the issues too, where the whole business about going to the spring and trying having to choose a gender is basically symbolic of becoming an adult. And various characters have various degrees of hopes or resistances to that concept. Like, what happens to you if you refuse to become an adult? What happens to you if you want to never make a choice about what gender you are? Well, then the choice is made for you, and that can have some pretty devastating emotional consequences too. Now, the factor that makes some people a little antsy about this series is that it's basically a Yuri series. The Simoon pilots have to work in pairs, and they have to kiss each other before getting into their ships to kind of help activate their ships. Never really explain why they have to do that. That's just kind of, I think, the fan pandering aspect.
Yeah, I can think of a couple reasons, but yes.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of stuff about relationships too. There's stuff about how characters are relating to each other on different socioeconomic levels, coming from entirely different philosophies and stuff like this. It's really a pretty remarkable series because of the tone and the way it approaches things. It's not like really the very slanderous kind of approach to Yuri that you see in a lot of the other more purely fan service oriented series out there. So I think it's a series that where the writing gets distinctly better as the series goes on. It's pretty good at the beginning, and then it's absolutely spectacular in the late going. And it's really the way the series improves and the way it deals with all these issues that, again, you just don't really see dealt with in really any other anime title out there that practically forced me to put this on my list.
I now vaguely remember that show, and I remember, I think I saw one episode of it and dismissed it based on the Yuri gimmick, but apparently it's pretty good, so cool. Is that still in print, do you know?
Boy, I'm not sure about that. I got my, that came out in, 2007, 2008, I think.
I received some copies from a fan to review, so that it would be like four or five reviews from now just in the list as far as when I got them. But when I looked up the price, like, it's pretty easy to find pretty much everywhere.
Cool. Okay, so that brings us to Hope, your number 10.
Okay, so first of all, the All-Star-Rans and the I guess, philosophy behind how I structured the top 10. Well, the also-rans are kind of going to hit as each number hits, because what happened was I was trying to figure out how I was going to organize this top 10, because I didn't want it to be just my top 10 favorites, because I've kind of done that for one thing. And for another thing, I just didn't think it would be as interesting for me, and it wouldn't involve, you know, having to... I kind of know already in my heart what my top 10 favorites were, and I was like, well, I'm not going to... You know, I want to be motivated to check out all this other stuff and try to make something a little bit more large scale as far as determining like what the best of the aughts was. So I was like, well, let me try and make it a best list. And then I just kind of discovered that I couldn't do 10 best titles. So I started approaching it a little bit differently. And I discovered this because if you open up the encyclopedia and you start going through like the, okay, 80s and the 90s, and then you get to the aughts and it's like, about 60% of the page of everything ever released.
Right.
You know, 60% of anime history is in the last, you know, 10 years. Like, oh, shit. So, pardon my French. So I just kind of figured, well, let's see. Well, if I can't go by favorites, what does best really mean? Where do best and favorites overlap? So I did sort of a weird hybrid thing where I tried to think in terms of 10 facets of what makes anime the best of what it is or what it's trying to be. And just looking at my list of my favorite stuff, I started to break it down. Okay, what is this trying to accomplish? And what are these things trying to accomplish? And I tried to get things into a bracket of basically stuff that has the same appeal, and that would all be under one number. And I just picked my favorite out of whatever each of those colors were, I guess, out of the 10. Truth be told, though, there turned out to just be only 9. Different, I guess, colors of what the best facet of this anime is, and what the pinnacle of that artistic attempt is. So I added the 10th because I thought it wouldn't really be. It seemed obvious. I was like, well, what's missing from this, you know, list of artistic accomplishments? Well, the 10th thing that's missing and that really doesn't make it into a lot of top 10 lists, period, or top lists, is comedy. I think a lot of when people make best films of the decade or best anime of the decade or whatever, comedy gets a short shaft because it's considered, you know, escapist or silly or not that, you know, but it's invaluable. Comedy means a lot to people. And so my personal favorite comedy of the aughts, not of all time in anime, but that was in the 90s, so it doesn't count, is probably maybe the girliest thing on these lists, but All Run High School Host Club. So that's my number 10. But as far as, you know, anime comedy stuff that stood out, School Rumble, Azumanga Daioh, there's a lot of things. I think for most people, Azumanga Daioh would be the top. But for me, it's All Run High School Host Club. And what a good anime comedy to me accomplishes is there's not really – we have sort of an attachment to, like, sarcasm and bile and snark in the West, a little bit more than in Japan, maybe. Japan, there seems to be slightly more of a, not that there isn't a lot of snark and that there isn't a lot of commenting on trends in culture that they think are dumb or whatever, but it's, I don't know, it's a little bit more goofy, I suppose, especially in anime because it's a cartoon. But I don't know, for Ouran in particular, I liked that it's very commentative, but in a affectionate way. It's not trying to rip apart shoujo and saying, "Oh, you girls are stupid for, you know, enjoying this nonsense." It's very affectionate and appreciative toward where it came from, but it adopts a lot of things, a lot of little devices, like the little pointing hand from Utano when something's about to happen. So are you looking over there? Something's about to happen. There's a flashing arrow, and it builds and builds and builds, and then finally it pays off as if they know. Like, they know that it's dumb that they're going to put a banana peel on the ground and somebody's eventually going to slip on it. So, stuff like that. But, yeah, something that's affectionate to where it came from, but is still able to make fun of it. And I think Azumanga does that a lot, too. It just, I don't know, coming from a place of honest comedy that's heartwarming, and you can really like these characters instead of just making fun of them to hit, you know, to say, oh, this is a... this is something that's deserving of my superiority and ire over them or something, you know. It's a very affectionate show over on High School Host Club. And so it's my favorite comedy, and I think number 10 on my list would be all the anime comedies that genuinely made me laugh and make you want to share them with other people. And, you know, because it does get the short shaft on best of lists like this. But comedy is really, really important to a lot of people. So, yeah, my number 10 are on High School Host Club, I guess.
Yeah, I enjoyed that show, and I agree with you that it's an effect. It's sort of a good-natured ribbing of shoujo sort of cliches. I like that show a lot. It's not on my list. It's not even anywhere near my list. Not even runner up. Nothing. I didn't rewatch it. I didn't feel any need to go back to it. But it's a fun little show. Okay, so you're number 10, Ouran. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've kind of felt the same way about it. But the thing about Ouran that stuck out for me is that it wasn't ashamed to make its Bishonen characters unlikable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really rare. Anime has this really bad habit of making its hot characters really, really lovable and making its ugly characters unlikable and clear villains and delineating visually that way. And it's very shallow that way a lot of times. Yeah. And I was really kind of taken aback. One of the twins in particular is kind of an asshole, and we are not supposed to really like him.
Right. Yeah, I guess the other little thing I hadn't mentioned about what to me makes an effective comedy is that at some points there is some depth to it. There is something you can kind of take away from it and really think about. And a large part of that in Ouran comes from the twins. It comes from if you treat people like something less than human. From a young age, they're raised to be, oh, look, there's two of a completed set, and they look just like each other, and let's dress them up in outfits. And, you know, then you essentially create something less than human. And when the twins get older, in order to kind of think of themselves as something that's, what's the word, I guess, as put themselves in a position above people that were kind of thinking of them as cute little dolls, they kind of become monsters. And so, weirdly enough, even though it's played for laughs, as twins are like, oh, those sociopaths, it's a little bit heartbreaking, too. It's like, well, you know, you made them that way. So what do you expect? Spoiled little rich kids that aren't really taught about human empathy from a young age.
Right. Cool. All right. I'm glad that was on someone's list. So that brings us to Justin, your also-rans, your philosophy, and your number 10.
All right. Well, yeah, this is for you and myself, Zach. This is our third time around this block.
Yeah, yeah, you don't really need to go into this
round actually was a little different because the 2000s, if you look at the history of anime, the 2000s was the decade in which anime became truly commoditized. Right. We had a ton more material than we had in previous decades, and a lot of it was very samey. A lot of it was not particularly standout or artistic. It was made for the sake of making a product. And while you can make great stuff that way, and some of the stuff on my list actually is, very genre focused, you're not getting nearly as much of the short, feature length, high art kind of the works that are very centric to the part of the director. I mean, we're not getting the great artisanal works this decade as much as we were in previous decades.
Yeah.
That said, they're doing some great things.
Right, yeah.
And there is some spectacular stuff, and you kind of have to refocus a little bit. So ultimately what I ended up deciding on doing is just in the macro view, how many of these shows would stand the test of time? How many would I remember in another 10 years? And actually, that made my list much shorter than I thought it would be. So I only have a handful of honorable mentions, and that includes Kino's Journey, mm-hmm. which I really like, but it's a little, unfortunately, it's episodic, and that makes it a little less impactful.
Yeah.
Gankutsuo, which visually is amazing, and the story is mostly very good. I really like it, and I don't really have any issues with it, but it just didn't make that much of an impact on me as much as the other shows.
Yeah.
Story of Sayunkoku, which I love and I think is entirely laudable for being one of the first truly feminist anime. Not feminism played for the enjoyment of guys, but truly feminist. We have a very strong hero, phalanxed by Bishonen, who she's not really all that interested in, but they're nice window dressing. Mm-hmm. She's a career woman.
Yeah, that one was one of my personal favorites too, but honestly, it's not really that well animated a series in terms of the visuals, and the story has definite lag points too. Still, I love the series, and I absolutely agree with your comments about how it's really one of really set up to make one of the best of all anime heroines, I think.
Right. It's pretty great, and it broke my heart that it was in, the whole thing was in print for such a short amount of time here.
Yeah.
Also on my also ran three obvious ones that I'm that just got bumped for better things: Haruhi, Eden of the East, and Paprika. So that said, my number 10 is Princess Tutu.
Okay. All right.
Yay. And,
yes.
Hooray.
I really love this show. This show, I just get this big shit-eating grin on my face whenever I pop it in. It is majestic. It is adorable. And it is really, really dark. While staying fairly true to the whole concept of magical girls and the ballet Swan Lake, it's... Let's see. The thing about Princess Tutu that I really enjoyed the most is how it kind of it started to fall apart as a fairy tale construct, and we started to see kind of behind the scenes. It almost took kind of a Wizard of Oz approach to Swan Lake and the world of ballet, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I get what you. Yeah, they're peeling the curtain back for sure.
Right, exactly. And that's refreshing. I mean, magical girl as a genre is something that you don't see. Well, you see it played with a lot. You don't really see it really evaluated as, for what it is. And
yeah,
I thought
that Madoka thing was totally derivative, seriously.
Well, yeah, totally. this came so many years before Madoka. You can't really put them in the same boat. But at the same time, it's a show that still stays approachable, even though it goes some heady places. It's something that you can still mostly show younger kids, you know, maybe with a little parental guidance. I just love it to death. It's really cute and really fun, and the characters are very memorable, and it has great music. It's just sticks out as something unique and fun.
Cool. All right. I expect we'll probably be hearing more about Princess Tutu later. that one came up a lot when discussing the these particular years in here. I think a lot of people feel like it's woefully underappreciated.
I really wanted to put that one on my list, but it just couldn't quite slip it in with some of the other titles that I put on. But it's definitely would be in my also ran list too.
Okay. All right, that brings us to my number 10, I did this the same way I do all these, which is I watch a shitload of material, and I revisit things that I remember really fondly, and I try to make it so that the list is not based on nostalgia, it's not based on memories, it's based on these things that I've seen right now and can give you my honest summation of them right now. This is how I feel about this stuff now, not sort of a memory. And to wit, I watched more material for this goddamn list than I have seen. Like, I can't believe I watched the whole thing. Like, it's absolutely ridiculous. But there's a ton of also-rans, and I think one of my biggest surprises and kind of regrets is that nothing that I watched for the first time made it onto my list. And I watched a lot of stuff for the first time, but none of it made it on my list.
It's a very similar experience for me. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's stress.
I think it's just because when you're talking about, like, when we did the 90s lists, that's all memory. That's all like, oh, man, remember 1997, sitting down watching, you know, VHS of Cowboy Bebop or whatever. And then you go back and look at it again, and it's like, well, I don't know. But, you know, these were the years where I was becoming an adult. I was graduating college. You know, this is the most recent decade of my adult life. And so the nostalgia wasn't so much there. It wasn't so much like, ah, fond memories. It was just like, yeah, I remember seeing that. Does it still hold up 7 years later or whatever? So the process is a little bit different. And the sheer just amount of material made that this was the hardest list for me to assemble of all of them. I feel like the 80s and the 90s came together a lot faster, but it took me months to compile this. To put this together, and mostly it was a process of evaluation, like figuring out, okay, what really do I want to put on here? And these are my, you know, 10 favorites. I don't think they're objectively the best, but I didn't put anything on there that I thought was like fun junk that I really like. Maybe not junk, but fun, something fun that I really enjoy, but, you know, maybe it's not so impactful. So the biggest also ran that I'm sure people are going to be a little shocked that it's not on my list. Redline, not on my list.
Okay, yes, I am shocked.
I am too.
Not on my list. I realized Redline is empty. It's I love that movie. I love looking at it. It is a really fun roller coaster ride. But if I said, okay, in the last 10 years of my life, what were the most impactful experiences? What really left a mark on me? Riding on a roller coaster would not be one of those. I love Space Mountain. I go on Space Mountain on my lunch break sometimes. But I wouldn't put it on a top 10 life experiences of the last 10 years, you know. Redline's a lot of fun, and it's gorgeous, but it didn't feel right putting it on the list, because that's all I can say about it, is that it's gorgeous and it's fun. That's it. So, that's not on there. Princess Tutu did not make my list. I watched it for the first time. I feel like this is barely an also-ran. I don't think I liked it as much as a lot of other people did, and that's chiefly because I think I saw it too late. I feel like I can't help but compare it thematically to, even though it's different, it's hard to not think about Utena and Madoka when you're watching it now.
When I first saw it, I was like, oh, it's Utena Jr. Like, that's what I called it for the longest time. Yeah, which is
really a lot of people did when it came out.
Which isn't, I don't think that's really fair, but it's really hard to not make that comparison. And I feel like the first half of the show kind of blows compared to the second half. It took me way too long to get into it. Frankly, like, I had like 3 failed attempts at watching Princess Tutu. It took me a while to get into it. And the animation is kind of meh. It's okay. Character designs, meh. All right, you know. I really enjoyed it. I especially liked the last half of it, but I couldn't in good conscience put on my list when I feel like the first half. It just takes a really long time to get where it's going. I feel like it could have been a 13-episode show, and it would have been fine in 13 episodes. But also surprising that it's not on my list, Mind Game. I really like Mind Game, but I wouldn't put it on a list of my top 10 favorites. It's kind of hard to parse exactly why, but I enjoy Mind Game the way it looks, sort of. You know, it's unique. It's unique to a fault, the way it looks, and it's a great movie, but something
it's
about
really-
it.
Not all that emotionally impactful, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not. And that's ultimately my biggest problem with it. As a matter of fact, about halfway through it, I'm like, okay. Yeah, Mind Game. Okay. Like, it's like, where is this going to go? And then at the end of it, you're like, okay. You know, it's okay. Victorian Romance Emma, which I hadn't seen, didn't make my list. I liked it, but it's a trifle. It's a total trifle, I guess. It felt a little like Downton Abbey to me in terms of, wow, this is, you know, I'm into this, but is it really having an impact on me? Not really, no. I enjoyed it, though. It's a very good show. Like, these are all great shows that belong on anyone's top 10 list. They didn't make it on mine. So with that in mind, my number 10 is a little similar to the methodology that Hope was talking about, where I felt like I needed to have something on here that was representative of moe, like, as a movement. And I take a lot of shit for being sort of anti-moe and kind of crapping on those titles. But there was one that I loved, and that's Spice and Wolf, and that's my number 10. And the moe elements in that don't really... I mean, I think they actually work in that show, and it's chiefly because the central relationship between... God damn it.
Lawrence
and Hollow. Okay. Between the central relationship between Lawrence and Hollow works really well. And especially in the second season, I feel like it just gets better and better and better. And that show really pulled me in, and I didn't expect it to. That was like a unexpected surprise where I got really drawn into it. And ultimately, emotionally, it's a very satisfying and sad show. It's really done really well. And for something with heavy moe elements in it, it really worked for me. And so that, you know, it may be a little bit of a surprise that I have Spice and Wolf and not Redline, but yeah, I feel like I got more out of Spice and Wolf emotionally, storytelling wise, like it had more to offer. Not that you can even compare the two, but yeah.
Yeah. In case of Spice and Wolf, like I remember when I first started watching the second season, I was like, because I was, the animation takes a significant step down.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know if I can watch this because it is verbose. Yeah. And I'm not real great with talking heads sort of stuff. And I was like, I don't know if I can sit through this. And then it opened with it continuing to not get on my good side. It opened with a dream. I'm kind of biased against somebody has a bad dream and it says something about their character because I'm like, why couldn't you do that when they're awake? But there is a dream that Holo has that sort of opens the second season. And it's real, and it really justified doing it as a dream and not doing it in the real world in any way. And it was really like I almost don't remember most of the other individual events of that show compared to how they executed that. And it kind of won me back instantly, despite the fact that I was still hating the animation and everything. It's got a lot of just really deep soul to it. And yeah, it's not on my list, so I'm talking about it, but you know,
yeah. It's all in the writing on that one. But yeah, I feel like representative of moe as a thing. I wanted to have something on there, and that was the immediate, I mean, even without that consideration, it would probably still be number 10, but, that's sort of how I think about it is like, okay, what came out of that movement that I really liked? And it's like this. So, yeah, my number 10, Spice and Wolf. Okay, so that's number 10. We got so many reader lists that we are not going to get through them all, but we're going to read them. We're going to do 5 at the end of each segment here. Let me see if I can get anywhere near the bottom of where they start in my Twitter feed here. Hang on.
Well, that's 50, so that will give us through a tenth of them?
About, maybe less. Yeah, because we were still getting them up through last night. So
my God.
Okay, first out of the gate, Bamboo. She sent hers in, her number one, Psychono. And I asked her about this. I was like, dude. And she's like, I dread rewatching it because I'm sure my memories of it are much fonder. It's like, yeah, they're much fonder than
she's much younger than we are.
Number 2, Fruits Basket. Number 3, Full Metal Alchemist. I assume she means 2003 one. From Wraithnor, number 3, Gundam 00, number 2, Bakano, number 1, Gurren Lagann. I watched Gurren Lagann for this, and it's not on my list. It's an enjoyable show, but, eh. Is it on anyone else's? No, well, don't answer that. Okay, Kenshin 77, number 1, X TV series. Like I told you, these are really diverse. Like,
oh, shit.
Number 2, Bakano, number 3, Spirited Away. From Patriculus, number 1, Fooly Cooly. Number 2, Gurren Lagann. Number 3, Interstellar 5555. And from Silver Husky, number 1, Wolf's Rain. Well, with that username. Number 2, Oron. Number 3, Gungrave. Kind of surprised to see that. But a lot of people, that's one of the, Gungrave is one of those where it's like, hey, this is actually really good. And I just didn't have the patience to sit through because it's a very ugly show. But, yeah. Okay,
shoulders.
So.
Giant shoulders.
So that brings
nice
us...
out you and your shoulders.
So that brings us to Justin. You're up first for number 9.
Okay, my number 9 seems like I have to have a sports show on every one of these lists, but this is mine for the 2000s. It's Fighting Spirit, Hajime no Ippo.
Okay.
God, I fell in love with this show. The shonen sports tropes are, you know, there's nothing new about those. But The reason Ippo kind of stands head and shoulders above the others is because it's so rich in its characterization. Yeah, there are 5-episode-long arcs. That's one, you know, boxing match. Mm-hmm. But really, the time that I really treasure with those characters is the in-between episodes. I mean, we meet the main character, Ippo, when he is, like, he is a kid getting bullied. And he meets his future idol, Takamura, by chance, and he ends up boxing training just completely despite himself. It's something he never thought that he would ever do, and he ends up being a prodigy at it. And as a result, he meets new friends, and he ends up having, you know, a life-changing transformation. He ends up basically a champion, and we just kind of follow him through this life trajectory. Other manga have tried to do this, Major in particular, but they're not anywhere near as effective. Hajime no Ippo is just really emotionally satisfying and really intelligent with its characters, and everyone's likable, but everyone's flawed. It's just a really, really great watch. It's crack. I was watching this probably 6 or 7 episodes a day while working full time. And that's not easy to do.
No.
I think at my peak, I might have been doing like 12 or 13 a day.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's a long show, too. It is.
And it had a second season a few years later that was just as good. Picked up right where it left off. Only difference is it's widescreen. And I can't recommend it enough. This had a really mediocre dub that I would switch back and forth between because it was easier to watch marathon. But yeah, it's really not all that great. And a very, very short life because it got released as singles, a 76 episode series released as singles from Genion. And then literally the bricks that they released, the stack pack bricks, came out the month Genion closed shop.
So it's still pretty hard to get a hold of the whole thing, right?
It's might be impossible these days. Hmm. I mean, you would have to spelunk for every individual volume, I think. The bricks are nowhere to be found.
Yeah, and it's one of those shows where you're going to find a bunch of them for $1, and then one of them's going to be $100.
Oh, I'm quite sure. I luckily I got those bricks. I got forewarning that Genion was in trouble, so I'm like, I'm pre-ordering these.
yeah,
best thing I ever did. But yeah, if you can get your hands on it, it's well worth it. It's such a fun journey, and unfortunately, you're stuck with fan subs for the second season because no one. It's a sports anime. No one bought it.
Right. How many episodes total is the whole show?
Let's see, 76 plus 24, so...
About 100, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Hajime no Ippo, awesome. Okay, moving on, that's Theron, you're up next, number 9.
Okay, well, I basically distinguished between season 1s and season 2s when the seasons were released entirely separately, so that's why I am specifying Spice and Wolf 2 as my number 9 pick.
Okay.
I think most fans of the series, despite the downgrade in artistic quality, generally regard the second season as the better of the two.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty amazing it is, despite the fact that the main character, who can turn into this big giant wolf, never does it in the second season.
Yeah, I don't think they had the money for that, but yeah.
if you read the original novels, though, and I have, she never does in the original novels either. So it's not like... In fact, the anime is in many places a word for word adaptation of the novel. So pretty much what you see in the anime is what the novels were.
Okay.
It is a very talky series. I absolutely agree on that. But unlike a lot of the other really talky series, like one really talky series that kind of irritated me was Lucky Star. Mm. But unlike series like that, I just got totally wrapped up in the stuff that they were talking about. I mean, when I was watching season 1 of the series, I got to episode 2. There's basically nothing that happens except the two main leads talking to each other throughout the whole episode. And it was like, I got to the end of the episode and said, like, wow, 22 minutes have actually passed. Because it was just the character dynamics that they build over the course of the series, but I think especially in the second season, are just so strong. You just really don't see that one-on-one character interaction and relationship building going on in that series. Like, you just don't really see it pretty much anywhere else in anime, except for maybe one or two other titles out there. So, and I so completely fell in love with it that I am reading the novel series out. It's the novel series is already a couple of books beyond where the anime goes, and it's still pretty much the same stuff too. So it's just a very highly enjoyable series, despite the fact that the technical merits kind of went downhill a little bit there.
Nice. Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. Some about that show, it's the writing, and specifically the character writing that makes it as strong as it is. It's just really well done from a writing standpoint. Cool. All right, so you're number 9, Spice and Wolf, and then that brings us to... Spice and Wolf 2, sorry, specifically. Yeah, I just lump everything together, so... Hope, that brings us to your number 9.
Okay, well, now I'm actually kind of getting into what my list really was, because I had to add the 10th, because I was like, I only have 9 here, because the way I'd reorganized it, but, leading everybody, I'm sure, to go, girl picked Ouran High School, yeah, whatever, hush. this is kind of the start of the list, really, which was, animation for animation's sake. My number 9 is Interstellar 5555.
Okay.
And in order for it to kind of work and stand out, I think it did need stuff like this, and some also-rans here, Redline and Furikuri, need to have better than average stories. Like, you can't just have animation for animation's sake if there is zero meat there. But I don't know. I don't think people give Interstellar enough credit for kind of having a pretty... you don't have complex characters or anything. There's no dialogue, but it has a rather interesting, fairly touching, extremely well-paced story for being an hour of music videos. And it's definitely animation for animation's sake, and kind of reveling in, this can only be done this way, as Redline and Furikuri are. But I think it's sort of the standout example of that. For people that and what that stuff is really good for is kind of drawing in people that aren't really used to anime, like drawing in sort of an outside crowd, because it always, and I hadn't made this connection until I realized that a lot of people that never seen anime before liked Furikuri, and that always weirded me out. I'm like, why? It doesn't make any sense. It's very alienating. Half of it is like Japanese puns and references to stuff that they've never seen. Like, why? And I think a large part of that Redline, a little bit could be said the same of. It's not 100% accessible to people who don't know anything about some Japanesey stuff in there, but it really does a good job of bringing anybody from any background together to kind of appreciate it and get something out of it, even if they're not sure what it is, because in all those cases the story isn't particularly deep, but yeah, in the case of Interstellar, I thought that was the pinnacle of that, because it literally does not rely on any dialogue, any contextually maybe just the lyrics of the songs, but the way it's woven together, like when it ends, you really feel kind of deeply moved on some level, even though it is a silly story and it's very simple. But, it's a powerful experience, and it's one that can only be achieved through animation. So, number 9 slot, animation for animation's sake, with still a better-than-average story, an admirable affair, Interstellar. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I'm alive and on this show, so we'll be talking about that later. but, good pick. I agree. that brings us to my number 9, which... I didn't know if this was going to be on here, but upon looking back at it, yeah, sure. Number 9, Eden of the East. I liked the end of this way more than most people did. I thought it was actually really well done. I didn't need more, and this is only the TV series. I'm not including the movies. The movies are very much superfluous, I think. They feel unnecessary. But the TV show... I think for 11 episodes, tells a real quick, real concise, really interesting story that has a lot of really cool, fun, neat, big ideas in it that it doesn't necessarily fulfill. Like, it doesn't necessarily go all the way on a lot of this stuff, but this has so many big ideas in it that I'm not really expecting it to. And so I liked all the characters. The dog, little dog with the wings is great. It's extremely compelling, and once I decided to revisit it, because it had been a while since I'd seen it, I didn't, you know, I skipped, I was like, okay, I now remember what happens, now I remember what happens, so I would skip, you know, every couple episodes. But it's just incredibly compelling, and again, I think that ending is dynamite. I think it's really, really nicely handled. It doesn't answer all your questions, it doesn't give you the info dump where they tell you exactly everything that's going on, but it's making its point about a particular slice of Japanese society that I think is a really potent and well-delivered point about, you know, the possibility of what these people could be doing with their lives. I liked it a lot. I think Eden of the East is an achievement just on its own, just those 11 episodes, not even considering the movies or anything else. So, yeah, that's my number 9, Eden of the East. I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
I really agree. In retrospect, the movies don't really hold that much water for me.
Right.
But the TV series is impactful, and I guess the memory of the potential of it having the great ideas is much more compelling than the reality that comes home in the movies, in which it's kind of revealed that they don't really have any ideas.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And that potential as represented in the TV series is exciting. And before it's kind of ruined for you in those 11 episodes, right, it's like, wow, this is really going to go places. And that's something that's meaningful. It's like the first Matrix movie, you know? As though that comparison hasn't been made enough, but yeah.
Okay, I really enjoyed the series too. The movies were okay. I think I probably liked them a little better than you or Justin did, but I still think that the series is where the strength of that franchise is. This is one I really wanted to include in my list. I basically passed it on to the honorable mention because I was kind of hoping that somebody else would put it on their list. So I am really glad to see that you did pick it up.
Cool. All right. Hope.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be the maybe the slightly Debbie Downer on this one, that I didn't rewatch it for this list specifically because I happened to rewatch it just a couple months, you know, like 4 or 5 months ago, just for the heck of it. And I liked it much less on the second watch. And thanks for telling me now that I don't have to watch the movies, because I saw the first movie and I was just so not into it, and I never got around to the second one. Now I feel like I don't have to. The series to me is sort of like nothing but potential, and it's a little frustrating to me because I didn't see in execution a lot of the idea. It's like, this is an idea. It's like somebody stating an idea into the void and then not seeing their perspective on it as heavily as I wanted to. And you do see some perspective in it, but I don't know. Eden of the East to me felt like it should be longer and should be more committed, I suppose. And I was actually very frustrated. It's good. Don't get me wrong. It's good. It's memorable. I'm never going to forget watching it. I own it proudly. I bought it twice because I had the Blu-ray and I bought the DVD Blu-ray combo. But it is really frustrating to me because, and now after having seen it twice, it kind of feels like a big ball of potential that was just kind of laid on the ground and not tied together. And it really frustrated me actually. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's what kept the whole thing off my list, to be honest.
Someone swings for the fences. It doesn't quite make it. If I'm impressed enough by the attempt, sure. You know, I'll give it a pass, but I like that show a lot. Very compelling. All right. So user lists. Okay. Daniel Zelter, your friend and mine. Number one, Mind Game. Number two, Highlander, The Search for Vengeance.
Wait, what?
Daniel's out there, people.
Right.
Yeah. Number three, The Wallflower. I did not remember that The Wallflower existed.
It's a terrible show.
Yeah.
It's a Nabashin, so.
Yeah.
A low, particularly low budget Nabashin.
Yeah.
But it's very funny.
Sure. Okay, Coffee Tibbs.
Sure, dude.
Coffee Tibbs, number one, Last Exile. Not anywhere near anything I would consider a top 10, but, you know, it's on some of these lists. A lot of people have fond memories of that show. I just could not get into it. Number two, Erica Seven. Number three, Mushishi. Like I said, diverse. Paul Freeland. Number one, Yakitate Japan. Number two, Kamichu. Number three, Nodame Cantabile. Yeah. I think you could read these lists for days and not hit the same title twice.
Jeez, I like a lot of those shows. Yeah. Just like I can't consider them classics.
Yeah, yeah.
That last fellow in particular seems to like peaceful affairs.
Indeed. I always meant to see Nodame Cantabile. Never got to it. Always meant to. Anybody watch that?
Oh, yeah. It's quite enjoyable. And it had a fairly decent dub that was online for a time. I'm not sure if it still is. but no DVD.
Well, we'll see. Okay, Andrew Paplu, number one, Paprika, number two, Raider Die, number three, Gunbuster 2, a.k.a. Die Buster. Paprika, I didn't even consider it. I appreciate that movie and admire it way more than I actually enjoy it or like it. It's one of those where I mean, I love all of Satoshi Kon's movies, and that one is good, but it's not... Something about it in the long run, just... I don't know what it is.
It's not as impressive as it was when I first saw it. It blew me away at first. Now I'm just like, oh, it's good.
Yeah, Paprika. Yeah, but that's it. I love that opening credit sequence, and moving on. Okay. That was four, I think. So BioD42... Number three, Summer Wars. Number two, Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann. Number one, FMA Brotherhood. I think these are all bumping right up against the end of 2009. Okay, so that brings us to number eight. We're full steam ahead, guys. We're taking this journey. Okay, so number eight in the round-robin order. Hope, you are up first for number eight.
Okay, well, similar to Zach's... statement that he had to, he felt it was necessary to find something from the moe genre to appreciate and give its due as true quality. And for me, it's not moe, but it's something that moe is tied very strictly to, and it's my least favorite movement in anime. And it's not moe, it's new media, for lack of a better word. It's this thing of a series or a movie being only tied, being only comprehensible through its ties to the fans, the fan reactions, the tie-in material, that sort of thing. I don't know. It's like the internet and the instant feedback slowly influencing creation and just the way it has evolved. The also-rans here are stuff like Haruhi, EF Tell of Memories, stuff like that where, yeah, there's moe in it, but more than that, it's also this dependence on the fans to invest in it so much so that it almost doesn't stand alone. And I don't like that movement, and I don't like also the execution of it kind of being a little bit postmodern in a not positive way, the weirdness of, like, weirdness for weirdness' sake, anime in-jokes and wink-wink nod-nod for their own sake. But if you got to do it, and you've really got to do it in a way that I cannot do anything but respect, number eight, Garden of Sinners. You know, it really made me question why... when I judge things, when I critique anime, or like I use a similar metric that I do to, like... narrative film, particularly like Hollywood studio film, because that's kind of a metric that's ingrained into people's minds at a young age in this country anyway. And that's why I rebel so strongly against stuff like Haruhi and EF Tale of Memories and stuff like that, where I'm like, oh, come on, you expect me to know all this stuff? You expect me to sit down and look at a silhouette monologuing for an hour, etc., instead of developing things more naturally? And Garden of Sinners was so well done. And it was so unique, and it was so only in anime can this be done, that it made me question why. Like, why do you have to do it this way? Can you do it this other way? Can you break all those rules, all those strictures that you think are necessary to make good storytelling and still have good storytelling? And in the case of Garden of Sinners, I think you could, because it was very impactful. It made me think about... if the visual techniques being used were just for their own sake and for the sake of extracting emotion, which primarily they are. Garden of Sinners is mostly an emotional experience for all of the technobabble and like talk of, you know, the source of human evolution and whatever. It's mostly just an emotional experience, but there is some, and that's what the approach, the directorial approach to it is mostly for as well. It's visceral. It's gut-wrenching. It's, you know, it grabs you and shakes you, but there's you know, but it's not just cheap manipulation either. There is some extremely deep forethought put into how Garden of Sinners is constructed. It's I don't know, it really broke a lot of my misconceptions of the way that some of these new media anime are doing things is wrong. It changed my mind on that. It's the only thing that I had never seen before that made my list. And I don't know. I with stuff like Garden of Sinners, I'm like, well, if you can do it this well, and it's like seven movies that are all of different lengths and, again, sort of require an understanding of the prior material unless you watch them all in one go. And even then, you wish maybe that you had some supplemental material a little bit to tell where it's going. I don't know, but it's only in anime, and it's only in the direction that anime is taking right now could this be done. And if you can do it that well, then absolutely. So yeah, for sort of the new media and moe and the bread tangle of internet influencing creation in a direct way that it is, I think Garden of Sinners kind of can't be beat for that. So yeah, that's my number eight.
Okay, also my number eight.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, that's also my number eight is Garden of Sinners. I agree with everything you said. This was a no-brainer for inclusion on the list from the get-go. I was like, if we're doing Best of the Odds, Garden of Sinners is going to be on there somewhere. And I did not enjoy the process of watching these films. It is a slog. They are brutal and bloody and kind of horrible in some places and difficult to understand, and there's info-dumpy monologues all the way through it. But once you get to about the halfway point, and I watched them in the order that they were intended to be seen, the first one is not, it's the barrier of entry is really high. It tests your patience at every single turn. It is constantly giving you reasons to turn it off. But if you stick with it, the experience of having seen it, and it comes together so well in the end, I think you maybe would agree with that. That right, the ending of that, if you get through the whole thing, it's an exhausting experience, but it's such a rewarding finale. That it really makes it feel like it was all worth it. That the feeling of having seen it, the experience of having gone through it, is vastly superior to the experience of actually going through it. I likened it when I was watching them for reviewing, for review purposes. I likened it to, like, you know, I cut off one of these Hydras and three more pop up. You know, it feels like you never run out of movies because there's nine films or something like that. It just seems like it never ends or is going to end. And then once you get to the end, you're like, oh, like, wow, that's really clever. Like, it's super puzzle box that ultimately gives you the emotional payoff and the reasoning and understanding for all of it. I felt like during it I wanted supplemental material. Afterwards, I felt like, A, I never want to visit this world ever again. And B, I feel like I have a full understanding of what there is to know about this narrative just by having watched all these films. But it is one of the most unique and different and ultimately satisfying experiences I've had watching anime, certainly in the last 10 years. I really couldn't recommend it enough, and I'm happy that they're putting out a slightly more affordable version of it so people can get access to it and experience it if they want to. But yeah, Garden of Sinners, absolutely. Like, that is it is amazing. It's an amazing piece of work.
I just thought of this just struck me as a kind of a good way to sum up the experience of actually sitting through it was it because it was like I felt like I was blind because I'm going into it and it's breaking every rule that I hold true to be good storytelling and how this should be approached. And it's like, well, yeah, that's interesting, but it doesn't mean it's better. And it's sort of like being blindfolded and being led to a surprise party. And it's like, no, like, I want to, no, stop it. No, this is not the way you do this. And it's like, are you sure? Can you trust me? Can you trust me to break these rules? And then you get to the end, it takes the blindfold off, and you're like, oh, okay. And you forgive it somehow. And it's like, well, maybe I can't accept that things can change and be different from how I've been raised to think they should be if you really can do it well. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I had a pretty similar reaction to Zach on this one. I was thinking, okay, I've heard a lot of good stuff about this one, but I wasn't really convinced that it was that great until I got to the final movie and saw how it was all coming together in the very end. This made my list of one of the top releases of 2011 because that's when it finally came out in the United States officially. Right. I totally forgot that it was actually a 2000s title, which is the main reason why it's not on my list anywhere. But I absolutely agree that it came together much better in the end than it looked like it was going to early on.
Well, yeah, to the point where the ending transformed my entire opinion of it as a film series.
Oh, absolutely.
I have not. That's a rare experience where you're like, man, come on, what the hell is this doing? And, oh, like, that's, it's such a, it's one of the most potent examples of that I think I can think of in any medium, in live-action filmmaking that I've ever seen. It's just like, wow, holy shit.
The one anime comparison I can maybe think of, and I kind of had this series in mind when I was watching Garden of Sinners, it kind of reminded me in some senses of Boogie Pop Phantom, because Boogie Pop Phantom's got that kind of similar structure where it really jumps around and all over the place in the timeline. You practically have to keep notes to keep everything straight. But once you see how it's all coming together in the end, it just becomes quite a bit more impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Justin, I don't think you ever got around to this one.
No, I'll admit I've chickened out a few times because it's so intimidating.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's like I said, like I can't blame anyone for turning it off because it almost forces you to. It's like it's.
I didn't know that one human body could hold that much saliva, but.
Wait, saliva? Now I gotta see
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Surprise! There's spit in this.
Okay. All right, so that brings us to Justin, your number eight.
My number eight is probably one that will come up a lot. I'm surprised hasn't already, is Fullmetal Alchemist, the first series.
Oh, okay. That's lower than I thought it would be, but go ahead.
I mean, everyone loves this show. This is not a surprise. It is so compelling in its tale of the two boys who lost their mother and everything. And it, I almost feel like I'm wasting my time talking about it because everyone knows this show. Everyone who has seen it probably likes it an awful lot. It is one of the most mainstream of everything that came out in the 2000s. And it was also a gateway drug, one of the few that we've had in the last decade.
Yeah,
it's compelling in a way that Brotherhood, I think, is not. I've tried to watch Brotherhood a number of times, and I think Brotherhood tries to kind of gloss over the initial pain and misery of the origin story of Ed and Al. And I think that's what makes it so good. We sympathize with these characters so much and we want them to succeed so much. And I really appreciate it veering off manga and into weird Show Aikawa anti-American sentiment.
Yeah.
I really enjoy the political commentary. It's something that we don't get a lot of in anime. It makes great points about the roots of terrorism. It's really kind of unique and intelligent that way. And also, I have to say, Kesenai Tsumi is one of the best anime songs ever made. I could listen to that to the point where my neighbors will force me out of my apartment.
I can DDR to that to the point that...
yeah, something tells me that's going to come up later. Probably a couple times, but yeah,
one small footnote though, and this is just stupid, but I have to bring it up. Until this show came out, in an anime context, two brothers named Ed and Al were the two creepy middle-aged guys that were way too obsessed with Sailor Moon in my old anime club. So I'm really appreciative for this show because now when I hear two brothers named Ed and Al, I don't think of them. I think of Edward and Alphonse.
Was one of them 9 foot tall with a loincloth on?
No, but one of them did have a very, very wash-worn Sailor Moon t-shirt that was about 8 sizes too small.
Oh.
And a belly that protruded from it. It was, yeah.
Living stereotype.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I remember I moved to California in 2005. You know, that show was the hot shit then. And when I moved out here, I discovered there's a chain of stores called Ed and Al's Auto Sound. every time I saw it, I was like, I'm a nerd. Yeah. that'll come up again later. That brings us to Theron, your number eight.
Okay, well, my number eight, I'm classifying as a 2000s title, kind of on a technicality, because 3/4 of it was broadcast in 2009, and the remaining quarter was in the first season of 2010.
Yeah, that's okay.
And that would be Cross Game.
Okay.
I was basically utterly won over by this series with the first episode. I'm not a fan of sports series at all. This is, I think, the only sports, pure sports series that I've ever actually watched out as far as anime titles go. But the first episode was so overwhelming for me that I just had to see where the series was going to go next, and really never got off track with that. It's, yes, it's a baseball series, but it's also a series about confronting loss and moving on, because you've got two characters that both had different kinds of relationships with the same girl who dies at the end of the first episode. And they spend the next few years trying to figure out how to move on from that. And can they actually form a relationship with each other, despite the fact that one of them basically initially hates the other one over the fact that her older sister was spending too much time with this other guy when they were like in late elementary years. There are some points where the series sags a bit because it could kind of draw some things out a little bit through the middle, and the character designs are frankly not impressive. And that's why the series doesn't rate higher in my list than it does, but it's got a wonderfully powerful first episode. It's got a wonderfully powerful conclusion. And it even has a lot of baseball execution in it that doesn't really always execute the way you would expect it would. And that's one of the things that I really loved about the series. I find it very amusing that the director for this one, his other main series credit is one of the Transformers series, which really threw me off when I looked at that. It's just like, okay, this guy made Transformers, but yeah, he also made something like Crossgame. Okay, it seemed like kind of a disconnect there. But after hearing you guys, you and Justin talking about Touch so much in the '90s thing, and 80s. You guys saying, "Oh, this is so much better than Crossgame." Then I had to look at that and say, "Well, wait a minute. I really probably have to see Touch then at some point if it's really actually that much better than Crossgame, because Crossgame is pretty damn good."
I haven't seen Crossgame. I don't think that.
Yeah, I don't think we actually said that, because I saw a few episodes. I like it. The problem with Crossgame for me is that Mitsudachi basically just keeps remaking the same story over and over.
Yeah.
Changing some elements here and there, but it's basically just him rearranging the same puzzle pieces.
Yeah, it felt like, because I had watched Touch, and Touch is if you're going to watch that, it's a commitment, and you have to spend a lot of time watching it. I didn't feel like immediately moving on to something that I knew was very similar, both visually and story-wise. Like, I know, Justin, you'd made that point before that he basically just remakes it. And it's really good, but he's remaking something. I didn't really want to immediately dive back into poofy-haired baseball melodrama. So, yeah. I'll get to it at some point, maybe after a few more years have passed and I'm ready for more of that. But yeah, and I don't think we ever said that like Touch was like way better than Crossgame.
Maybe it was somebody you had on for a guest there, because I know that comment came up, and it was like, I was like, whoa, really? Kind of reaction. Possibly the reason I like this one as opposed to something like, say, that is because I haven't seen Touch yet. So maybe this is a case of whichever one you see first is the one that you're going to latch on to more.
I think that's probably likely.
Yeah.
I would say that doesn't sound like a stretch to me at all. Okay. All right, so that wraps up number 8. That brings us to user lists from Charred Knight. Number 1, Gurren Lagann. Number 2, Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood. Number 3, Millennium Actress. Cold Mist TV has number 3, Standalone Complex. Number 2, Haibane Renmei. Number 1, Kaiba. I watched Kaiba. It is not on my list. I enjoyed it. I feel like it was a neat idea that ultimately it's a good show.
I watched about an episode of it, just couldn't get into it.
Yeah, same here.
I gave it 5, and I was like, I don't want to keep going, so I didn't.
Yeah, I will fully admit, didn't finish it. I got a pretty good amount of the way through it. It's only like 12 or 13 episodes. Go Gaiolan says. Number three, Moribito. Number two, Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex. Number one, Paprika. Verde Sky says. Number one, Koikaze. Number two, Maihime. Number three, Gurren Lagann. Seen a lot of Gurren Lagann on here. Not a surprise, I guess, but yeah. Shoko Van Kluvi says, number one, Eva Rebuild. Number two, Bakemonogatari. Number three, Garden of Sinners. And Pensuke says, number one, Eden of the East. Number two, Ibane Renmei. Number three, Nodame Cantabile. I'm curious to see if anyone has Ibane Renmei on their list here. So anyway, that brings us to number seven. Moving right along. Justin, you're up first.
Okay, number seven for me is Mamoru Oshii's Skycrawlers.
Okay, interesting.
A lot of people hate this movie.
Yep.
I don't blame them, but I loves it to death.
Right.
And I think you have to be the sort of a very analytical person that can get past the frankly superficial story of the Kildren, the kids who repeat their lives over and over, waging a war that a fighter plane war that seems mostly there for the tourist attraction.
Uh-huh.
And you know, they die heroically and then they come back with different names but more or less the same appearance, and are doomed to just repeat themselves over and over because they're immortal. On its surface, I can see it just not adding up to much and being kind of boring. And what the hell is this? What am I watching? If you really look below the surface, it is just, it's a pretty vicious takedown of what anime has become and what kind of nerd culture has become in a way. It is just, everyone's just rewatching the same things over and over, slightly repackaged, more or less for, you know, young adults and teenagers, and just kind of living that out, and there's no escape from it. It's really, I mean, we don't get that kind of insightful satire very often in anime. Yeah. And, you know, satire doesn't have to be funny.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. As a matter of fact, like, I thought you didn't really need to scratch too hard to get what he was saying.
I didn't think so either, but a lot of people just, it eluded them entirely.
Yeah, the commentary on that film from the masses, I found actually to be fairly annoying, because it seemed like people just totally missed the point, and I thought it was super obvious.
I did too. I mean, it was alluded to in the press notes when I went and saw it.
Right.
The people being criticized don't get the joke. That's a big surprise.
That's depressing.
It's not on my list, but I really appreciated what that movie was saying and what he was trying to do. And I got the impression from it that Oshii is a little fed up.
You think?
Yeah, a little fed up. It's a very interesting thing, and I think anyone interested in something being sort of, it's a somber commentary. I mean, it's not a funny, satire-y thing. It's a somber commentary. But if someone's interested in that kind of thing, which we get almost none of in anime, that's, you gotta seek that one out.
I thought, you know, given how the 2000s played out and my purview that I discussed earlier of what the anime became in the 2000s, I think it was really essential, because here's a guy, Mamoru Oshii, who is synonymous with very artistic auteur anime, who has more or less been sidelined.
Right.
You know, that his era is over. And this is that point of view, and I'm frankly part of that point of view, that I enjoy the more auteur works, even if they veer off a cliff and are just terrible. I would take that over yet another generic harem show any day of the week.
Yeah, right.
So for someone that encapsulates that, both good and bad, I think that that point of view is very much worth hearing.
Yeah, I agree. Theron, Hope, anybody have a take on that one?
Never saw it.
I saw it round time it came out, and I don't think, I was already not really, I don't know, Oshii's just not my flavor. I don't, it doesn't really speak to me like some other directors do, so that was part of it. But so for me, Skycrawlers is just sort of a big gray. Well, this was dot, dot, dot. I don't think I got it at the time. I'd need to revisit it. Don't know.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Okay.
Like I said, not for everyone.
Yeah, it's not for everyone. It's totally, yeah, it's totally not.
Oshii in general, like, I don't know. I guess his brain and my brain were never meant to meet in the middle.
You know, even on his, even to someone who loves him like I do, he's hit and miss. I mean, for every Pat Labor 2, there's a, there's a Ghost in the Shell 2.
Right. Which, you know, over the years, people have really embraced. Like, huh? You know, that I think Mike had it pretty high up on his on one of his lists at some point. Innocence, people have embraced it. He is an acquired taste to a fault. So, yeah. All right, so moving on, number 7, that brings us to you, Theron. You're up.
Okay, well, my number 7 and number 6 picks are both going to the opposite end of the decade from my number 8 pick. For number 7, I've been a fan of basically all of Makoto Shinkai's work, so I had to include something from him on this list, and the one I decided to go with was his original, Voices of a Distant Star. It's only, what, 25, 26 minutes long, but I think in that 25 minutes, he perfectly nails down exactly the message that he wanted to send, and only that. And I thought it's a beautiful work of economy in anime storytelling. He's trying to tell a story about loneliness and making connections even across vast distances, and he found basically the ideal way to do it. I don't think there's anybody in anime that does a better job of making his movies feel sentimental in a good sense than what Shinkai does. Now, I think some of his works are more successful at that than others, but Voices of a Distant Star was the one that really nailed it the hardest, I thought, for me. Now, that being said, Voices of a Distant Star also prove that for everything else Shinkai can do, he can't do character designs. That's why I was really glad that in his later movies he left that work to somebody else. But the animation of it, especially with all the CG effects, is beautiful, for especially given that he made it on a Power Mac computer. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's hardly anybody in anime that does lighting effects as good as he does. Really, I found the movie to be an experience. This was one of these deals where I first saw it in a convention setting. It was like 2002, and the ADV release of it was just getting ready to come out. So it was listed on the program for one of the conventions I was at that time. So I said, oh, I've heard a lot about this, so I'm going to go and sit in it. And the room was probably packed, probably, I don't know, 150 people or something like that. I mean, it was standing room only to watch this. And I remember at the end of the movie, the entire room was silent. And it wasn't one of these, oh, silent, it's bad. It's like, whoa, we just watched something special kind of silences. And it's one of the titles that I've rewatched pretty much every year since this came out. And my opinion of it has never gone down.
Huh. I'm glad that's represented. I am not a fan of Shinkai, but of everything that he's done that I've sat through, that one I liked the most, in that I liked it at all. So, yeah, I think that's easily his, if you want to point to hey, here's how you know, what do you see from this guy? Voices of a Distant Star, I think, is the one I would point to first.
You know, the thing about Makoto Shinkai, and this might be a little harsh, but this is just how I see them. You ever see those galleries in some shopping malls? And I saw this in Las Vegas, where it's just kind of stock photography that looks nice, you know, of a nice pillar or of a nice nature shot, mm-hmm. but just had the contrast and color saturation cranked up.
Yep.
And I could see how that's very popular and something that people respond to, but it just seems so facile and, for lack of a better term, empty to me. There's emotion there, but it's not something that anyone had to really suss out anything through. It's not a they're not thought pieces. They're just kind of this meditation on a feeling. And I can see how that would be comforting to people, but it just it comes too easily for me. It doesn't seem like anything that's really worth long-term study in my book.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it got worse over time. With each passing film, anytime there's a fucking cicada in the background and then there's a long lingering shot of a train station at sunset, I wanted to just take my own life. I was like, I can't take any more of your drippy nostalgia. It's just, it seemed like treacle to me. But Voices of a Distant Star, not to just sit here and shit all over the guy, is, I think it's his strongest work. I won't
disagree that Shinkai has kind of had a problem with branching out in terms of what he does, because he's pretty much been doing this similar kinds of things over and over again. I kind of would like to see what he could accomplish if he did something different. Like in Voices of a Distant Star, he showed that he had a pretty good understanding of how to conduct mecha battles. I'd honestly love to see him go back and do a proper mecha series to see what he could do with that. So,
you know, he did a very, very short film in 2007 called A Gathering of Cats for the compilation Anikuri 15. It's a super deformed comedy about cats trying to take over the world.
Oh, I have not seen that.
It is fantastic. It was the funniest thing. I was cracking up for longer than the show's runtime. Do more of that. Stop with the nostalgia.
Well, when you guys kept mentioning Shinkai, I could only tie him back to when I mentioned the number 8 thing and where anime is going. The construction of mise-en-scene and the narrative itself, pulling the narrative into emotional reaction over context and substance and continuity that's not tied to just facts, or, you know, that's tied to an inner meaning. That's kind of what I think of, which... and a lot of the, again, like a lot of the new media stuff is in like the year 2011, 2012, 2010. So not a whole lot of it was in 00 to 09, but that's why I felt it had to be mentioned, because that's kind of where anime is going. And I wonder if that's why Shinkai does resonate so much with people that are further steeped into anime. Because Shinkai doesn't seem to grab people that aren't really steeped in that particular mindset that watching a lot of anime, particularly new anime, seems to get you into, which is, you know, it's very different from the narrative approach in Western cinema.
Are we talking about a narrative approach, or are we talking about nostalgia for something that you never experienced?
I wasn't talking about his love of nostalgia, because that's in, that's there, but I just mean more... The way the movies are constructed is more about trying to suss out an emotion. That if I can pick something from 10 to 12 to talk about this, like Angel Beats, it's more about trying to suss out an emotion. And if you want the further context for it, then and I love Angel Beats, but if you want the further context for it, well, that's on you, friendo. But the actual execution is more about trying to suss out an image or a carnal reaction to something than it is about actually constructing a story the way that it's conventionally supposed to be done and can be called quote-unquote good. And that's why I had to bring up Garden of Sinners at all, is I was like, well, you know, there is a good way to do this, but, you know, I think people that are less steeped in anime rebel against it more, because for us it's like, no, it's not the way you do it, you know, but whatever. I don't know. Shinkai, I guess, to me, I kind of agree. Like, I think Shinkai kind of makes jello movies, but Voices of a Distant Star is the best of the ones that I've seen, so okay.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then that brings us to your number 7, Hope.
My number 7, this is sort of the facet that I adopted here is a step up from the animation for animation's sake thing. And it's the story is more important, but it's not particularly ambitious. This is pure, sincere entertainment and escapism for its own sake that's really done well. And some also-rans here are, I don't know how much people will agree with this, but Get Sack... kind of gets standalone complex. I say get sack and then I say it out loud and I'm like, I shouldn't have said that out loud. Let's call it standalone complex. It's Samurai Champloo. But the actual choice here, my number 7, Baccano. Again, the nice thing about this is that it's widely accessible to just about everybody. And it's, you can kind of jump into it at any random point, which Baccano a little less so, cause it is an ongoing narrative, but, so for it's not so much an episode like it would be for Samurai Champloo. You can jump into any episode, but you can jump into any scene in Baccano and just kind of like instantly understand who these people are and kind of like them. It's amazing how there's not really even the worst people in Baccano. You can't hate them. There's everybody is likable. The devil himself is a character in Baccano is likable. And, it's so, wholeheartedly embracing of, we are here to entertain you and we're here to do it well. And you're going to love it and attach to it, very deeply, even though there's really not much of substance to be had. So, and that's a lot of anime. Like, that's a lot of anime that I think wants to accomplish that, just wants to be entertainment for its own sake. But, to make that enduring and to make that, like, really, really get something out of you is difficult. And Baccano, like, I've rewatched it, I can't say how many times. And people have watched it with me, I can't say how many times, from all different, you know, backgrounds and, I guess, deepness in anime fandom. Some hardcore fans and some, you know, like, not fans at all. And it, because it is just, it's pure entertainment. Every moment, really. And it's a little harder to get into at the beginning, but once you've seen it, when you go back to that stuff at the beginning, it's just as entertaining because you have a little more context for it. So I don't know. Baccano was probably on this entire list the most biased personal favorite kind of pick, but I cannot help but be, I guess, in awe of how shallow it is, and it doesn't even matter. It's so entertaining. I think Gurren Lagann kind of fits in this quarter too. Like, that's really, really succeeds at being entertainment for its own sake, but still having artistic merit. Baccano is just so lovable, and it does feel like artistically valid, even though it's really pretty simple, pretty dumb fun. Love all those characters. They're all written really well. You kind of understand why the evil people are evil, and you for some reason sort of go, well, you know, maybe that's okay. And it's like, wait, what am I talking about? In fact, there's very few people in Baccano that could be considered good by any measure of real world context, but there's no real world context to Baccano. It is its own thing. They managed to kind of fool you into okaying the behavior of all these crazy criminals and killers and stuff like that, but not, it doesn't feel harsh. It's so lighthearted and so happy. And so, yeah, number 7, Baccano.
Sweet. Well, I am glad to see that this was on somebody's list, because I had to reduce it to my honorable mention list. But yeah, I really enjoyed Baccano a lot. I agree with a lot of what you said about it. I do think it needs to be said, however, that Baccano is an incredibly graphically violent series.
Yep.
Do absolutely be aware of what you're getting into before you sit down to watch it, because there is some really, honestly, pretty sick stuff in it. But that being said, it is still I agree, there's still quite a few lovable characters. I mean, Lad Russo is the total, utter psychopath. He goes, like, stomping around gleefully in somebody's blood. And, again, it's just really hard to hate the guy because, I mean, he's a total loony, but he's so much fun to watch. And, that's really true for a lot of the cast.
And he has, and it's amazing that they were able to create and make you feel for, he has a fiance who is sort of like a empty-headed masochistic doll. And it, I can't imagine writing that and not having it come across as repulsive and not what it is in the show, which is really sweet. I don't know how this happened.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's so sweet. It's like, oh, Lad and Lou are so in love. No, he's a sadist and she's a masochist and they're just sort of, like, dependent on one another, and that should be horribly creepy, but it's not. I don't get it. It's great.
Well, let's not forget together either the couple of the psychopath and the silent female assassin.
The solipsist and the mute. Yeah.
Yeah, that end up. I think that they end up like getting engaged or something. It's like you're actually rooting for them, even though these are some, again, under any other context, these would be some pretty disgusting characters.
He proposes while covered 100% head to toe in blood.
Yes.
And it's not his. Ugh. And I was a room with like five or six girls watching that scene, and they all went, oh, and you know, he's on a like most charming guys list for a lot of people. And it's like, he's covered in blood, guys.
You know,
but yeah, entertainment for entertainment's sake. I don't think you can get much higher than Bacchano there.
This is one of those shows that I think this is the power of it being animation.
Yeah.
If you did any of this stuff with live action, it would be repulsive.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
I think that extra level of being removed from the corporeality of a guy being covered in blood is what makes that a romantic scene.
Yeah.
This show will come up later. So, yeah. All right. So that brings us to my number 7, which I didn't know was going to still be on here. I thought it might be, but it totally is. Genshiken. Which I'm specifically talking about the first season of this show. I don't necessarily like what Genshiken became, but the first season of the show is a very specific reason it's on here, and that is because it is the only show that, because you know, anime in the 2000s increasingly became about otaku and about otaku culture. This show is a warm-hearted and incredibly accurate. In many cases, extremely accurate depiction of the sort of banal interaction between anime club members. It reminded me so heavily of my days in my anime club, and the interactions between the characters and the character types, the personality types, were so well done and so recognizable to me that it's like a record of, hey, this is what anime clubs are like. Like, and it totally is. It's incredibly accurate. And I like all the characters. It's also very funny. And it's very slice of lifey. There's not, you know, not a lot happens in it. But it's, yeah, a lot of people have problems with it. A lot of people, you know, I've heard a lot of complaints about it over the years. But as just in this first season, not the dumb spinoff, not the fact that they turned the joke show into an actual show, and not, you know, the second season. But just this first season, I felt was incredibly sweet. Bittersweet in many cases, and accurate portrayal of what people are like in an anime club. And being in an anime club was so formative for me in my late teens and early 20s, and in late high school and in college. It's an integral part of why I became an anime fan in the first place. And so this show kind of represents a time and a place for me that was integral to my becoming a fan and deciding to work with it for a living. So yeah, Genshiken, totally number 7. Big fan, really, really big fan of that first season.
I got to pull down to my pants here. Hold on.
I know you're not a fan, Justin.
No, I mean, you know, it was a formative experience for me too, and I get that. And it is a very good depiction of that kind of, you know, fuck around with your buddies who also like anime sort of life.
Right.
That said. There is something about the pacing of this show, I think, and it doesn't work at all for me. It makes every joke fall flat. It makes every character interaction strained. I can't get into it. It's like nails on a chalkboard for me.
See, I feel like that was deliberate because these people are naturally very awkward. And so the interaction reminded me of how awkward it was talking the anime club guys, like the long pauses and the awkward stops and just it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's not particularly pleasant, but that's how it was. Like, that's how those people are. Yeah. So I guess that brings us to, I don't know if anybody else has anything against Ken.
I'm going to mention it briefly in number 6. Not that it's my number 6, but again, I have a weird list. So
okay.
I like the series quite a bit. I didn't really connect to it as much as you apparently did, Zach, probably because I was through college before I really started getting seriously into anime, so I've never actually been part of an anime club. But kind of looking back at the ratings that I gave the series when it was first coming out, I actually rated it better than I remembered rating it, so I must have really respected it at the time I saw it.
Yeah, I fully admit this is a sentimental choice for me. I don't necessarily, I wouldn't, you know, certainly wouldn't put it on a list of the, here are what I think the, you know, 10 greatest artistic achievements of the 2000s, like, no. but it meant so much to me and still means a lot to me when I watch it. It's special to me. So, yeah, anyway. All right, user lists. Let's move on for number 7. Ed Sizemore, your friend of mine, cheated. He is a dirty cheater and wrote, number 1, the works of Satoshi Kon, number 2, the works of Makoto Shinkai, and number 3, the Ghost in the Shell franchise. So way to cheat and break the rules, Ed. G. Tebbets has number 3, Cromartie High School. Didn't expect to see that on any list at all, but there it is. Number 2, Millennium Actress, number 1, Fooly Cooly.
Oh, there's a list.
Yeah.
That is, yeah.
Brian Ra, also our friend. He had number 3, Skycrawlers. Number 2, Fooly Cooly. Number 1, Redline. Let's see here. Anime Nerd 25 list. Number 1, Baccano. Number 2, Fate Stay Night. Number 3, Tenshi Muyo GXP.
So, really?
So, way to go, man. Maybe he's trolling. I don't know. Steezy 121 list. Number 1, Bakemonogatari. Number 2, Honey and Clover. Number 3, Welcome to the NHK. I rewatched.
Good choices.
Yeah, I liked NHK. It's not on my list, but I enjoy that show.
Yeah, both NHK and Honey and Clover made pretty deep impressions on me. Yeah, I struggled a bit with what to do with NHK. It didn't even make my also-rans just because it's a little thematically all over the place.
Yeah, no kidding. So. I'm not, like, by the end of that show, I feel like I know what it's trying to say, but do I? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little, yeah. All right, Kuroshinko has number 3, Samurai Champloo. Number 2, Millennium Actress. Number 1, Paprika. I'm surprised I'm not seeing more Champloo. Rolling Penguin 7, number 1, Mushishi, number 2, Fooly Cooly, number 3, Aoi Bungaku.
I'm always surprised at how popular Mushishi is, because it really didn't make that much of an impression on me.
Nope. Me neither.
I love it. It's not on my list, but yeah, I it's one of my favorites. I like how... I think when I last talked about it on a top list or something like that, it was that people, I don't think, realize how much, like, Western influence there is in anime. Like, there is a lot of it. It just, not just in storytelling style, but also for as different as it is, just in the content itself, and westernizing even some of the Japanese folktales a little bit. Unless they really want to go for an artsy piece and then nobody ever watches it, like, over here anyway, like Mononoke or Ayakashi or that sort of thing. But Mushishi is, like, somehow crosses a boundary where it helps. It's very, very, very steeped in Japanese tradition, but it's accessible to everyone. But it doesn't just cross over into Western tradition just to make it more universal. And I thought it was very moving. There's always something new visual happening in every episode. You know, I love that show. Yeah.
I can respect that.
It's a series that I respect more than I like.
Yeah. The one thing about it is I loved the first episode to death. Just loved it. I think I cried watching it. But now, then I watched each subsequent episode and I was like, oh, we're just doing this again.
Yeah, that it did seem awfully repetitive. I don't think I ever finished it.
I barely did.
Okay, moving on. Number 6. Time for number 6. Rolling right along here, and we're going to start number 6 with Theron. You're up first.
All right, well, my number 6, again, is at the early end of the decade, and it's the one movie on my list. It's Spirited Away.
Okay.
And I felt that I had to include this. It was originally going to be my 9th or 10th pick, but then I rewatched it. About a month or so ago, and I said, man, this stands up really well despite 10 years having passed, and it impressed me all over again, I think. Do I necessarily consider it the best of the Miyazaki films? Yeah, I was always more of a fan of Princess Mononoke, but this is a really good looking film. It's really well made, and it's got a really good English dub to it. And it's also highly respected on a lot of critics lists that from critics that aren't even anime fans. I was looking at one list earlier today, which said that it's there's two different lists, which put it among the top 10 highest rated movies of the decade. And that's across the board, not just anime or even animation related movies. So I thought it was a remarkable visual accomplishment. It's got a neat lead character to it. I was kind of a little iffy on the kind of somewhat forced environmental message in the middle of it, but that's really about my only complaint about it.
Yeah, we've talked about Spirited Away a little bit. I don't know what it is, but I shrug at Spirited Away. I Justin, I know you're kind of in the boat with me on this one.
Yeah, I am. It's got a lot of great things in it, and I do need to rewatch it after a little more of the context of what Helen McCarthy was talking about on our Helen McCarthy show.
Right.
But it seems to me to be the first Miyazaki movie that started an unfortunate trend of pointlessness. You know, it's just like, well, that was a bunch of stuff that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and it like that. I feel like that's a good way to describe the plot of Spirited Away. Sure is a bunch of stuff that happens.
And howls.
I disagree. Ponyo. All right, well, I disagree absolutely. Now Spirited Away, not my favorite Miyazaki. It's sort of, I think it's third, but when I say it's third, I have a three-way tie for first. It's never been broken, so it's actually fifth, but whatever. But there are many Ghibli films, Miyazaki films, that I don't really have any personal attachment to, and I have some deep personal attachment to Spirited Away because I think it means more. I'm going to mention it later. It's not on my list. It's just a sort of a, you know, companion piece also or anything, but like it means a lot the younger you are, if that makes any sense. Not just because ooh, pretty, wonder, etc., but it's does a really good job of introducing the themes of strength and self. What's the word? Not self-esteem. That's self-reliance. That instead of just saying it and it not really sticking and people going, oh, I know what this movie, or little kids even, going, oh, I know what this movie is trying to say, but they don't really care. It does it subliminally in a way that really means something. And for many kids, I think maybe that's the first time they're introduced to stuff like that that really, really means something. So I think, like, yeah, I mean, what is her name? Chihiro. Okay. Chihiro is, you know, oh, she's a strong female character, like in all of Miyazaki's movies. But, you know, she doesn't start out that way. And the way that they evolve her through the movie and the way that you inherently admire her, if you're a kid, like, I think particularly a little girl, I mean, it is inspiring and you learn through it without even thinking about it. You know, so it's not preaching a message of you need to be self-reliant or whatever. It just displays it and you believe it and you get lost in it. And yeah, like I deeply respect Spirited Away for the same reason that I deeply respect the concept of children's animation a lot. But I'll get to that later. So yeah, I love Spirited Away.
Cool. Yeah. No, I think Justin and I both acknowledge we are outliers on Spirited Away, and it's impossible to not recognize that in that decade, that movie winning the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature Film, The impact of that cannot be downplayed or denied. It was one of the most significant events in the history of this little world that we play around in to ever happen. I don't know if it'll ever happen again, but that movie won an Academy Award. So,
and I do still like it. I don't want to give the impression that I don't. Oh, I'll buy the Blu-ray as soon as it comes out.
This is like this is one of those. Well, it's not as good as the other movies that I love with all my heart. Like
It's like this is okay. It's better than Cat Returns.
Yeah, it is.
No, I actually, again, when it comes to personal attachment, like, I like Howl's Moving Castle more than, it's not nearly as good a movie. I like Howl's Moving Castle more than I like Spirited Away. But yeah, I mean, like, it's not a, oh, I should respect this. I do have deep personal attachment to that film as well. So, yeah.
Okay, well, I hope that brings us to your number six.
Okay, well, my number six facet or tier is a slice of life, as in pure slice, like, there is no reason that this should be animated, but through animation, it becomes presented in a way you couldn't do in live action. And the also-rans here, Honey and Clover, Genshin, Beck and Paradise Kiss, which are totally the same show, but with the gender switched. Osamu Kobayashi probably shouldn't be let near many fantasy things. Weirdly enough, he works in animation, but he does such an amazing job of representing reality, pure reality, through animation. Which those aren't the actual list topper here, but Beck and Paradise Kiss should be watched just to, like, you can, like, smell and taste and feel those shows. When they're down in the basement where the band is playing in Beck, like, you can feel the sweat in the air. It's amazing how good he is at capturing reality through animation, which is why it's interesting that he's really, like, his Panty and Stocking and Gurren Lagann episodes are so terrible. Like, he just shouldn't do fantasy, I don't think. But the list topper here, what I find to be the pinnacle of slice of life in animation, utilizing animation to the best ability with some real nards on it, Welcome to the NHK. It is unabashedly gallows humor. Just absolutely... it's not mean-spirited, because I can't stand mean-spirited humor. And I would say most people think they can't, but there's a lot of people that enjoy... humor with an element of mean-spiritedness to it, and I can't even, like, the slightest bit. But Welcome to the NHK is not mean-spirited, but it's honest about really, really sad things, which are some people are sort of always going to be predisposed to loneliness because that's how they are, and they can't escape it because they need other people's help to escape it, and it's a catch-22, you know? It's a little bit of what, you know, a lot of the themes that were being explored in Evangelion, only in a different context. But, you know, I think ultimately, not to spoil too much, but it's so darkly humorous that I think at some point it goes, well, how do you escape this spiral of loneliness and lack of will to survive? And it's like, well, you get really hungry or the power gets shut off. And that's what, you know, gets you up and gets you moving again. And, that, you know, it's so bleak and honest, but kind. I think it loves its characters, and all of its characters are horrible, but it still loves them. Like, every one of them. All four of the main characters are not people you would ever want to be with in real life. All of them. And yet you enjoy watching them every step of the way, and the way that the fantasies, Sato's fantasies are executed is great. Again, only in animation could you execute them that way. And added to that is the fact that it was adapted... Some slice of life stuff is adapted from, like, really long anthologies of comics, and they just go panel for panel. Welcome to the NHK is based off of, like, one 90-page book, which did not cover any of the events that happened in it. They turned one 90-page book into 26 episodes of concepts and elaborations on... he, like, sort of goes through, like, different stages of hell, and each time he gets out of one, he falls into a different one, but they're sort of related, and you can see how they link to one another, and, you know, that he drags all these other people down in it with him, and I don't know. I really loved it. I love how, I guess, wise it is in its own really cold, crass way, and it feels very true to life, but still worthy of being animated. The only thing that really kind of stabs it in the foot is Sato's mania is a little bit weird considering he's not in the book, I believe, if I remember correctly, he was a drug addict, and that kind of added to the fantasies and the mania and the paranoia. And they took that out because I suppose they just didn't want to write in a drug addiction into the story. So he gets a little extreme. He gets a little cartoony for the context of the rest of the show. But... Welcome to the NHK is probably the best slice of life anime as far as it being really in tune with reality and committing to it, while still being a little funny and silly that I've seen. So that's my number six.
Cool. No, I really like that that analysis of that show.
That's very well put.
Yeah, well put. So Justin, that brings us to your number six.
My number six, I'm sure will come up again later on a lot of other lists, but it's my number six. It's Haibane Renmei.
Okay.
Boy, is this show beautiful. If it's a moody day, all I have to do is watch the opening, and I am just sucked into another world. A very moody, I don't want to say depressed, but perhaps overly thoughtful world. But I like it. It's... A lot of people have attributed a lot of a lot of meanings to this show, mostly about suicide. And I think those are fair interpretations. Some of them are actually quite obvious if you look at it. But I like that it's not about that. It's about kind of being outside of your comfort zone and trying to figure out why you're here, which is, I think, something, you know, that's a great existential struggle. And from the point of view of these girls who are essentially angels that pop up in this kind of odd European city that they can't leave, it's really very unique and very compelling. I've never seen anything like it. Beautiful music, absolutely beautiful music, really, really memorable characters, and a first episode that really, it's a little bit grotesque to watch as the characters, when they land in this world, they all get hatched from an egg and have to sprout their wings out of the flesh of their backs. It makes your flesh crawl. It's uncomfortable to watch. But I think that's really necessary to the progression of the show, because it takes the viewer out of their comfort zone and ready to just kind of accept this new unfamiliar world on its own basis. And I think that's very much relates to how the characters proceed.
Yeah, I think that scene actually sets you up. It sets your expectations for the tone of the show real early on. Like that, yeah. It's really important to that show, is that early scene of that, because it's like that image is burned into my head of the wings coming out of that girl's back.
Oh yeah.
And you know, that show didn't make my list just because I feel like ultimately it's less than the sum of its parts. That's kind of how I felt about the way the show ended up. But that's indelible. That imagery is indelible, and it really sets the tone for the show, which is a weird ass tone. it's discordant. Yeah, for sure.
And it's
there's no good way to market High Bonnie Redmayne. Yeah. There's no good way to describe it to people. Say you should see this because, and you just go, just see it.
And that was part of the reason why I held off for years on getting around to see this, because I heard people talk about it, but it just never really sounded that interesting. And then back in about August or so, I heard it was coming out on DVD a second time. I said, oh, okay, I guess I better break down and finally check this out. And I ended up watching it like two times in this completely through in the space of about 3 weeks. It was one of those series that once I started getting into it, I basically didn't stop.
Yeah.
It didn't quite make my list. It was on my list at about the number 9 spot for a while, but I ultimately dropped it to the honorable mentions in favor of Spice and Wolf 2. But it was a really close call on including that, because I really liked the way it handled things. It kept kind of a low key tone throughout, but yet it was still pushing the story and character progression along, and I was very, very impressed with how it ended too.
Yeah, this is one of those shows that I really, really wish it had a better dub. I mean, it has an okay dub, but it's very mediocre. I think if this show had a truly great, very nuanced dub, it could be a really great high art gateway drug.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, see, I have to disagree with you on that, because I rather liked the dub job on it. I thought it was quite solid.
It's well made, but there's something that a lot of LA produced dubs have, where the voice actors are too used to talking in this affected, exaggerated sort of way, and that it almost replaces actual acting. So there's very little nuance to their voices. Everyone just kind of talks like this, and it works most of the time.
Yeah. It's a little too upbeat. Like, that whole show has a real somber tone to it, but the voice act, the dub, seems weirdly upbeat. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
It's definitely more than listenable. Like, I've watched High Bonnie Redmayne maybe twice, and both times it was in English, and I think I got the full effect. They did pick more naturalistic voices, but the only problem is they get, well, maybe with the exception of Raka, they do sort of stay in one tonal mode through it. Like, basically, what you're looking for is people to talk, like, almost as naturally as possible. So any amount of theatrical delivery gets is maybe a little too much, like any tiny amount, but it's actually quite good considering what how it could have turned out. But yeah, I see completely where you're coming from there. At least it is completely listenable. Like, at least I don't think it hampers the show. It just
no. Like I said, it's not terrible.
Okay, I have Hunter and me. So that brings us to my number six, which is, as mentioned before, Interstellar 5555. I agree with everything Hope said. I've talked about this on the podcast plenty of times. Really don't feel like I need to get into it too much more, other than to say I do feel like it is the epitome of anime can be really fucking cool, and Interstellar 555 is fucking cool. And I do want to point out that there's an interesting shift, because I rewatched this recently, and the first four were animated on a different budget. The first four segments were animated on a different budget than the last. And you can the animation changes abruptly, and you go from theatrical quality animation to more of an OVA look, more of a digital style. It's an interesting shift, but it still works. And it also helps that I think that the album that this is based on is one of the best albums of all time. One of my favorite things in the world. I fucking love Interstellar 5555. It's great, great stuff. If you, for whatever reason, haven't seen it, go see it, but get the DVD, because the Blu-ray is garbage. The DVD actually looks better on an upscale than the Blu-ray does. So make sure you get
the favorite DVD. Segment from the movie, maybe?
Oh, Digital Love, for sure. Maybe Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger, but Digital Love is real special.
Oh, same here.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to user lists. We are almost at the halfway point, guys. Okay. Let's see. I'm just going to start. Okay, Rolling Penguin, number one, Mushishi, number two... Nope, we already read that one. God damn it. Divine Nigga, number one, Shingu, Secret of the Stellar Wars. Isn't that a 90s show?
No, it's 2000. It's early 2000s.
Okay.
I like it, but it's so low-key.
Number two, Kishiren Sins, number three, Gungrave. Mad Scientist 212, number one, Princess Tutu, number two, Erica Seven, number three, Hibane Renmei. Luca Q, number three, Samurai Champloo, number two, 12 Kingdoms, number one, Tokyo Godfathers. I was kind of expecting to see more 12 Kingdoms, but I guess that's kind of in there with Morabito, where it's like, either you're a big fan of it and you've seen it, or you haven't.
The big problem with 12 Kingdoms is that it's so steeped in its own mythology that it comes across sometimes as impenetrable.
It also doesn't end, right?
No, it got prematurely cut off pretty much after... What was it, 45 episodes, I think? There were more books that they had planned to animate, but they just, for whatever reason, ended it.
It kind of ends. It's not like a really dissatisfying ending. It's several self-contained stories anyway.
Right.
So it's not like there are no endings to be had in it. There are just, it leaves off kind of truncating one.
Right. It's on my also-ran list, but I left it off the list in favor of something that I thought was on all points better that has yet to come up yet.
I think you and I did exactly the same thing. We'll see.
Okay, Wandering Waves. Number one, Ghost in the Shell, Standalone Complex. Number two, Monster. Really shocked that this is the first mention of Monster and we're half done. Number three, Full Metal Alchemist. And from Fancy Hut, number one, Diebuster. I'm shocked I've seen that more than once.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Diebuster sucks, guys.
Oh.
I mean, it doesn't suck, but it's... Whatever. Anyway, number two, Birdie the Mighty, Decode. Number three, Ghost in the Shell, Standalone Complex. And from Harlan Man, number one, Kaiba. Number two, Mind Game. Number three, Mononoke. Did not get to Mononoke.
I didn't either.
Don't know.
I didn't.
If you didn't like Mushishi, you'd like this less.
Okay.
It has less emotional resonance on a universal level than even Mushishi. It's just like, well, these are some old stories done in kind of an interesting visual style, but I don't know. It wouldn't have made your list, I don't think.
All right. Well, then I don't need to bother with it. Okay, that wraps up part one of Revenge of the 2000s. Big thanks to Justin Savakis, Theron Martin, and Hope Chapman for showing up. You can listen to the conclusion of this episode next week. And I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time.